Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Help for JHD Radio. I'm your host, Dina Canastracy. Help for HD International would like to thank our sponsors, Teva and the Griffin Foundation, for making this radio show possible. I'd like to give you a brief background on myself and my connection to JHD, and then I'll introduce our guest today. I'm the mother of a 5-year-old child with JHD, who was diagnosed at age 4 after a year-long battle with doctors trying to explain her decline in motor skills, speech, swallowing, and seizures. I'm also married to my husband for 20 years, who's in the mid-stages of HD, and I have 2 other children at risk for the disease. Today, Kinzer Cancelmo is joining me, and she's a JHD mother and wife to a husband who had HD, and she's an advocate for HD awareness. Thank you for joining us, Kinzer.
Sure, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how HD and JHD entered your life.
As you have said, my husband had Huntington's disease. He inherited it from his dad. And he was diagnosed at a fairly young age. He was about 37 when he actually received his diagnosis. And I had just had my youngest daughter had actually just turned 1 at that time. So he had Huntington's disease for about, I don't know how many years. I mean, I took care of him for quite some time. His first symptoms were cognitive. And I took care of him for quite some time, and then I had to put him into a nursing home because it was no longer safe for me to take care of him. And I also have 2 children. One, as you had said, was diagnosed with juvenile Huntington's disease. I'll let you ask more questions because I could just go on and I'll let you take the reins now.
So with your husband, you said you first noticed some cognitive decline and things like that. What were the first signs that you noticed in Megan, your daughter with JHD, and how old was she at the time?
Megan was actually diagnosed. She was clinically diagnosed. Everybody's always talking about CAJ repeats and everything like that in children. And I went to a center of excellence, and her neurologist actually was able to just clinically diagnose her because of my husband's diagnosis. She looked at her and did a few motor tests on her and said, we don't need to do a blood test. I'm going to clinically diagnose her if that's okay, which was absolutely fine with me. She was 10 at the age. And oddly enough, one of the first symptoms that I saw in her, which it sounds very strange, but she carried her arm in a certain way, and particularly when she was running, her arm would be up and out, and that was like the first sign from my husband. So I don't know, that just kind of clicked with me, and I thought, oh, my Lord, my daughter, I think, has juvenile Huntington's disease. And then everything from there started clicking in place. She struggled academically, you know, throughout her elementary education years. You know, she had the diagnosis of ADHD, ADD, you name it. She was on meds for things. And in reality, I think she had been misdiagnosed all along.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be very common, having those different labels. So it sounds like you had some type of awareness that perhaps there was a juvenile component. Did you know about juvenile HD prior to you suspecting it in her? Like, you could jump to that conclusion right away, or did you not know and just took her in and then, you know, they explained that it could happen this young?
I did know about juvenile Huntington's disease. When my husband was diagnosed, we were members of a support group. He was actually diagnosed by, we lived in Connecticut at the time, and we participated in the UConn Huntington's disease program, which was just phenomenal in both diagnosing and helping us throughout his journey. And they provided lots of education, lots of support, and I had known about juvenile Huntington's disease, even though it was very rare I did know it existed. So when Megan started having educational problems, I didn't think anything about it. I did, however, have a psychoeducational test done on her in the very last paragraph in that test. The psychologist said that he had done some research on his own and he feared she may have juvenile Huntington's disease, which, as you can imagine, just put me through the roof.
Sure. Gosh. So it sounds like you didn't have any difficulty in getting your diagnosis, whereas if you've heard my story, I had a significant challenge in doing so, as it seems like the age of the child seems to be what most people were going after, or they felt that there was no point in knowing, right? If she had it. So if she has it, what's the point in knowing? Can you explain, maybe, did things change after you got that diagnosis for the better or for worse? What was your experience in getting that diagnosis at that time?
Well, I think we just were more on board with her seeing the neurologist more frequently. We had quarterly trips to the Center of Excellence, which is right here in Boston, Mass. And so the neurologist was following her very closely. I was also able to get prescriptions for what she needed in the school setting. And that was just instrumental in keeping her involved and engaged in school. And like you said, I know a lot of people have so many problems not only getting the diagnosis, but then trying to get people on board with the services that the kids need, you know, both educationally as well as physically and emotionally and, you know, occupational therapy, everything like that. And I have to say that we were blessed in that respect, in that the school department couldn't do enough for us in terms of getting her hooked up with all the necessary services that she needed. And that really was instrumental in her, you know, getting through her school day, right down to a one-to-one para, which if anyone is listening and, you know, is struggling with school right now, you get your IEP and you get that one-to-one para, and it really does make all the difference in the world.
Oh, fantastic. Did you notice, maybe, were there any changes to maybe Megan's self-esteem when she started getting the support, whereas before there wasn't that understanding as to why she's declining or things like that? Did she notice anything like that with now she's getting the right medication, the right support, the change in services? Did that have a positive impact on her, do you think?
You know, Megan's journey is very, very different. And I know every child's journey is different than the other, than the next ones. But Megan was a terror in her younger years. You know, there weren't enough hours in the day. I didn't have enough arms to keep track of her. I spent more time in the school disciplinarian's office than I did talking to her teachers. It seems like between first and second grade, she did a 180 and she went back to school, and the teachers were asking, who is this child? And I hadn't done anything yet in terms of getting a diagnosis or anything, that, you know, nothing. She just kind of did a flip-flop, which was unbelievable. Then she started getting really, really, really shy. She didn't want to do anything. She didn't want to see people. So I think the additional support in school, she looked forward to these people who were familiar to her, that she knew were there to help her. And therefore, she was comfortable with them because they made her feel that way. So so in that respect, that engagement there was really critical for her.
That's good. That's good. I'm very happy that you got the support you need. It'd be really instrumental for the entire JHD community to have that type of you know, open-armed welcome, you know, let's get this diagnosed and get you the support you need to have the best outcomes. Now, what did you find, what were the difference between symptoms that your husband had in the course of the disease versus Megan with JHD?
Well, my husband, I mean, he called a lot of his own symptoms in the beginning. Like I said, he recognized initially that his beginning symptoms were cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
So he realized he could no longer work. He couldn't do the job that he was doing any longer. And so he, mm-hmm. what we called, retired. Then we went through the disability process and did that whole piece. And he tried to stay, I mean, he was like the push. He was like the poster child for the HD world, right? He you know, tried to stay active. You know, he was an avid runner. He would go to the gym.
Yeah.
He would, you know, eat healthy. He would do everything that they encourage you to do. And I credit that to being on the right meds and getting the right support. And, you know, that really is instrumental in providing the correct environment for somebody. Get that support, get hooked up, and get the doctors on board and make sure that you're also on board and understanding every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
With children, as you know, it's a very different animal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what symptoms did she have? Like, did you have different treatments for her symptoms? Did you have issues with maybe availability of medications because she was a juvenile and not an adult?
Absolutely.
Did you have any?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, everything, in spite of the fact that she was seeing a neurologist who had a few JHD patients, and she's actually she's a wonderful neurologist, and I trusted her wholeheartedly. I never questioned anything that she prescribed. She knew her stuff. But even with that being said, because the medicine is so not what am I looking? What are the words I'm looking for? It's not out there for kids.
No.
So you're trying either smaller doses that are typically given to adults, or you're trying things that work for other issues to see if they might also work
off-label.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so everything with Meg was trial and error. And when you're talking about a child, you know, dosage was huge. Side effects were huge. You know, we went through a gamut of medicine before we would even come across something that might help one thing, but then another symptom would pop up that we'd have to deal with.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, because I've explored that, you know, of course, going through the process of, you know, is my child have JHD? And then now I'm just post getting the diagnosis in April. I feel like I'm at this fight with, you know, okay, well, what's available, right? And I'm finding that most of it is exactly as you describe, is it's, we just don't know. And some of the things that I find alarming are that medications that are even widely used for ADHD type of treatments in even the children population can have very negative effects in the JHD child.
Absolutely, and they can exacerbate that, you know.
Which is
unfortunate, we found, you know.
Did you have that experience on a stimulant medication for the ADHD?
But that was before she was diagnosed. So
right.
You have to wonder what it did for down the road for her. You know what I mean? She was taking Concerta. You know, she had terrible stomach aches. She was taking another med that I forgot the name of, and, you know, other side effects with that. And then down the road in her JHD path, we had a lot of stomach issues. You know, you got to wonder if there was a correlation there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I hear that's common in our groups. You know, a lot of the kids have experienced some stomach pain. And interestingly, when my Megan, we both have daughters with the
Oh,
same
yeah.
name. Yeah. My Megan, when she first started declining, would complain often of stomach pain. This is before she was even on any medication, and she developed a extreme appetite. You know, every half hour, I'm hungry to the point of
Yeah.
tears, and we couldn't understand. And I just said, you know what? We're gonna stop the mommy thing. Right? And I'm just going to feed the need of the child instead and not listen to the doctors, which is, you know, you just need to set a schedule for eating. You don't really need to tell me I'm a mom of three. I know the drill, but she's different, right? It was different. It was a cry for food, and my stomach hurt after she ate. And we went through, she does have some food allergies, and we went through more allergy testing, and it all came back negative. So it just makes you wonder kind of what's going on there. And did she experience any seizures? I mean, Megan's first symptoms were seizures. Did your Megan have seizures as well? Were they early or
Yeah,
later in the disease, or?
they were much later. They were she didn't have her first seizure until 1 year ago. So I thought we had, bypassed that.
Right, yeah. And see, there's a distinct difference between the adult version and the child version is the experience of the seizures as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I can imagine the road you traveled with all these medications and trusting the doctors when, you know, I look out on the PubMed database and I'm looking for JHD, a lot of the studies that have been done are not regarding medication. They are just research studies on history, an examination of, you know, 12 children with JHD. That's great. That doesn't treat what's going on right now, right? I want to
Yeah.
know how that ADHD drug is doing, right? What is it going to do to them? So
Well,
how was that for you as a mother? How did that make you feel, not knowing what these medications would do?
I have to be honest in saying that I placed my full faith in her neurologist in Boston at Mass General. I didn't question anything because I knew this woman ate, breathed, and slept both Huntington's and juvenile Huntington's. Both she and her husband do. So I know if two people were going to know anything about it, it was going to be these two. And so I just, she would tell me something. I might look it up, to see what was going on, and I certainly would check the adverse effects, but she would also tell me what they were. So that was, I had to go with it. I trusted her.
That's good. I'm really glad you had that support. It would be really great if we could see more of that extended to everyone across the country and the world, right? To
Oh my
have
gosh,
those
yes.
people. Personally, I've had many doors closed. You know, I've had Center of Excellences, you know, say, oh, I don't treat children. So I've had to drive to another one even further away, or just have a local pediatric neurologist that says, well, I've seen it once before, so let's try it again. And that kind of gives you little willies, right? To say,
Well, and I
okay, but
will
I don't want her to
say,
be an experiment for you.
and that's exactly right. Our local pediatric neurologists were absolutely they were terrible. They I they were terrible. I don't even know if I had to work with them, I don't know what I would have had to done. I just I had no faith in them. I even and I'll go be so brave as to say this because I know a lot of other people are either thinking it or going to do it or have already done it, but I did the cannabis route and I did it all on my own and I researched it and I did the consulting and I found that to be more helpful for Megan than any other drug that was ever tried on her.
Wow, that's a powerful, yeah. And That's really good to know. I mean, as our country starts evaluating opening that up legally, I know Florida has voted on it once and it was denied, but it was denied usually based on what's in the bill, not necessarily that they want to deny the options, right? So I know it's, I think it's up for vote again this November. So it'd be really nice if that could be passed. And but then you have the challenges getting a doctor on board, right, to be willing to try that. But so, because I've heard that there's less side effects with that. Is that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But you're absolutely right too, in that I could not find. You need two, for Massachusetts anyhow, you need two board-certified pediatric doctors that will sign for her in order to get her a card, and then, therefore, you can use the distillery or whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
not the distillery, you know what I'm saying. But there weren't any doctors to be found anywhere that would do this, which is why I took it into my own hands and sought out a consultant also not too far from here and used to visit him regularly. By then, Megan couldn't even drive in the car. She couldn't sit for longer than going around the block because the neuropathy in her legs was so bad that for her to sit, you would have thought I was putting her on fire, you know. I knew that was going to lead into something else. Go ahead.
Yes, we'll talk about that. Yeah. That's interesting you say that regarding the neuropathy in the legs. I think that there is a definite lack of information and documentation of all the symptoms that the children have in the progression of the disease. I see in our community many mothers are reaching out and to any doctor who will listen, and they're being ignored that this is caused by the neurodegeneration of JHD, and yet when you ask the mothers, they're like, yes, my child had that, and either nothing worked or it did work, and it just seems like we can't get consistency around the symptoms and the right treatments for our children. So would you mind talking about that a little bit, about the, specifically the pain in her legs?
Just that it's very, very real. I don't care what any doctor says. And her neurologist didn't deny it. It's just can't figure out what to do to help it. But I can tell you that we started doing telemedicine via the computer because our last trip to Boston, which is roughly an hour and a half away, she stood for about an hour and 20 minutes in the car. I could not get this girl to sit because it was so uncomfortable. So it took three of us to get her down there. And I'm not even going to say safely because, you know, without a seatbelt on.
Sure, yeah.
It's against the law. So, but I haven't found a doctor yet, including her neurologist, that can figure out, you know, and maybe she, you know, I don't think there's been anything coming down the pike that I've heard of. And I know others that I talk to, particularly in the JHD groups, they have the same issues, and nobody can seem to figure that out. But I'm here to tell you, it's very, very real. My daughter stood all the time. The only time that she would sit and be comfortable would be if she was in her wheelchair and you were going for walks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, explain that one. Most doctors would say it's in her head. Well, I think not, you know, unless you're living here.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I've heard a lot of the it's in her head, or it was behavioral. You know, we had Megan's 5 now, and she still will have an accident in her pants, and she truly doesn't know that she's had a bowel movement. And that was a big struggle with me and doctors, is that, you know, oh, you're not doing the right techniques, it's behavioral, it's this, it's not neurological. And then I read that incontinence is part of it. I'm like, what? You know, you don't live with me, you're not seeing that we're establishing regular potty times. We've been doing this since she was 2 years old. You know, she's the only one of my children, and she's the one that pops up with the early onset. And but for the treatment of the neuropathy, when they say that they didn't have any options available, did they explain that perhaps maybe there are medications? Because neuropathy has a lot of websites, because of course every time I read these things, as I was definitely thinking that my Megan had this, I would research all the symptoms you guys had and trying to build actually my own little book of what things can I bring to a doctor when she encounters this. I read the posts and I say, oh, this worked for so and so. So I'm kind of like developing my own little guidebook on what I might encounter, and not every child is the same for sure, but that seems to be very common, and I find there's plenty of websites and people who do suffer from neuropathy and this extreme pain, and there are entire networks, and they keep saying it's so treatable, and while I understand that we're dealing with a neurodegenerative disease, which is probably the underlying reason for the nerve cells and all of that, but if it's treatable, why isn't it being explored in our children, right? So did you hear maybe the drugs used to treat neuropathy have not been tested in children, and that's why they didn't prescribe it? Or did you try various treatments and they just didn't produce results?
You'd have to name some of the drugs. I'm drawing a complete blank right now. I want to
like
say
GABA something, right? Gabapentin.
Yeah. She was on.
Yes.
And that was going to be my first drug I was going to name. The gabapentin didn't help a whole lot. It helped for some other symptoms, and it also helped with sleep. That was like a seizure. That was supposed
yes.
to help with seizures too. So a lot of these drugs I think had another benefit too. I didn't necessarily know that was for the neuropathy, or maybe I did and I just don't remember. But yes, she was taking that. She was also taking something called Sinemet, and I want to
uh-huh.
say that might have been for the neuropathy also.
Neuropathy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they just didn't produce the results. So there were attempts made. But, okay. It would be really nice, I think, if there were some research done into the cause of that, because that seems to be something that these kids, you know, in the late stages suffer from very greatly, but yet there's either no kids have it, or I just don't know what to do. And
right.
That's pretty painful for the kids. So
it sure is, yeah.
Yeah. What was your biggest challenge you faced when you're caring for your husband and Megan?
Well, thankfully, it wasn't together. They didn't have it together. I took care of my husband. He had it for just about 15 years. And I was able to keep him home for a long time, but it got to the point where he needed more care than I could provide, where he was getting hurt a lot, and I still had to work full time. So I couldn't give up my job, and
right.
I had somebody come into the house for a few hours a day, and I think the biggest challenge was trying to keep him safe and knowing that he would be all right when I was at work.
Mm-hmm.
And also knowing that my girls were in school and I didn't want them coming home, God, heaven forbid, to find something that
right.
would have
right.
been the worst possible thing, you know? So,
sure.
And I also knew that in working with the UConn Huntington's Disease Program, that we had a facility about an hour away from us that specialized in Huntington's disease care. And I started visiting them and trying to see if that would be a viable option for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what accommodations did you need at home for Megan, and how did you go about getting those services, and did you have any challenges in doing so?
I didn't really need any accommodations for a long time. She was pretty good. So the one accommodation I did make, because I saw it coming down the pike, was a stair lift, because we have a two-floor house, and I could see the day coming when she'd be tumbling down the stairs. So I had a stair lift put in, and that was the beginning of the end of everything for her.
Oh, no.
She was riding up the stair lift last January, and she got to the top, and as you know, HD, same with JHD, they're impatient. They want everything yesterday, and they don't want to wait. And she used to have a hard time getting off, swinging the chair around and getting off at the top of the stairs. And I said, hold on a minute, and she didn't. So she went to get off, and she fell down the stairs.
Oh, bless her heart.
And so from that point forward, everything from last January on started going downhill. That was really the only accommodation I made while she was here. Well, that's not true either, because after that fall, she never went back to school. So I had to get an in-home tutor, and I had to apply for MassHealth so that I could get a person come in to take care of her while I was at work. So if you consider those to be accommodations, yeah, I did have a lot to do.
So while you mentioned that the care of your husband became overwhelming and you had availability to put him in a home, it sounds like you needed someone to come. You know, I can imagine you're working full time and now Megan can't attend school. How did that work with, did you have any option like that, or was there any consideration for a home for her, or did you have challenges getting someone into the home to care for her during the day with her special needs?
I was very fortunate in that I did have a home care agency that linked me up with somebody who great with her, just came in and took over and learned about Huntington's and, you know, empowered her and didn't give up, and And Megan grew to love her. She was like her second mother, and it was just it was beautiful. I couldn't have been more blessed in that respect.
Oh, good.
It, you know, which was great, but the challenge is from when I got home from work, because then by this time the girl wasn't sleeping. That was another issue we ran into. Not sleeping and the itchiness. So I managed or averaged probably 1 to 2 hours a night of sleep because she wouldn't sleep. So I'd get up and start all over again, wait for her CPA to come. PCA, sorry. I'm all over the place. To come to take care of her, and off to work I'd go. So that worked out very well until she was an absolute train wreck and wasn't sleeping at all, was ridiculousness, writhing around on the floor, you know, banging her head on the floor, crying, can't sleep, can't, you know, so itchy, uncomfortable. I couldn't do anything to help her. I finally had to bring her to the ER and say, I need help. And that's when the fighting began, because they are not equipped to handle a very rare disease.
So a hospital, in your opinion, right, your experience, was not equipped to handle someone with JHD.
Not a
center
all.
That you're looking for help, right? They treat
not
people
all
day. Oh, wow. And how so?
No. What? Well, they could handle, you know, one issue, you know, they ruled out, I guess, a yeast infection. That stopped one thing. Then they were trying to work on her sleeping, which until the day she died, they could never get straight. They worked on and off with her neurologist at in Boston. Mm-hmm. It didn't work well. She ended up in the hospital for over 100 days.
Wow.
I couldn't find a facility that could handle her needs. This is where mm-hmm. our system is lacking. I had a 15-year-old mm-hmm. daughter that I couldn't take home because I couldn't care for her, yet there was no place that could handle her because of her neurological, neurodegenerative disease. Maybe there was a place about 2.5 hours away, but this girl was used to having me there every single night
sure.
with her service dog. Now,
right.
you know as well as I know that that would have been the end of her.
Mm-hmm.
That would mm-hmm. she would have died.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started my fight, both politically and with every person I could drag into this nightmare
mm-hmm.
to get her the services and the rights that this girl deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I fought from July of last year until November when she passed to try to do what she deserved and what was right for her.
Mm-hmm. And she wasn't able to leave the hospital, though. That
was not.
At the point, no. I'm very sorry.
They thought she was. They were ready to release her because they would view her as a problem, you know. Well, we can't do anything more for her, you know, and then they'd want to put her back on me. And, you know, it was so wrong to the point where, because I wouldn't pick her up, they filed a 51A for neglect against me with our Department of Children and Family Services. So
mm-hmm.
then I had a social worker who came in and had to do a whole investigation to see, you know, if I was neglecting her and this and that and the other thing. So that was a whole nother nightmare, you know, right? Because as if things aren't bad enough, now I got a social services agency in my business trying to figure out, you know, what on earth is going on here because the hospital files this against this woman
mm-hmm.
Because she's not taking her daughter home.
Right, and they probably know so little about Huntington's, much less the fact that there's a juvenile component and what it really means, right? So I hear that often from people when they see bruises and bumps on their children, they get the services called on them. Right? When we're like,
absolutely.
But this is part of the disease. It's a motor disease. It's a cognitive disease. They will get injured, but the parents are called in. And that's kind of a fear of mine. I document pictures all the time and ask daycare for, I need evidence of a accident report because I can't take her home with that bump on her head. It happened here. You know, and I'm going to take a picture of it because, you know, yes, she fell on the playground, she did it, but it's due to her discoordination. But it is my fear that, not that I don't trust those people, but you bring her into the ER for something and she's got lumps and bumps all over her leg and a bump on her,
right.
You know, them not knowing. All right. And I don't think
that's
it matters
right.
to the extent that the child has progressed. Like you said, you've got a late stage daughter and, you know, I'm sure the CPS people were like looking at you like, what did you do to her?
Yep. How'd she get that? You know, and
yeah,
it's crazy. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we shouldn't have to deal with that in addition to everything else that we're
right.
know, trying to handle.
Exactly. Do you have any caregiving advice that you found that did help Megan through the journey that you could share?
Caregiving advice.
Boy, like, were there any fun or neat, like, pool noodles, you know, like, I heard all sorts of
yeah,
interesting
well,
uses
yeah,
for things.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I broke down, and I got her this huge blow-up pool bounce house slide.
Ah, yes, okay,
for the
yeah.
backyard that she loved last year, and her service dog would go in it with her, and just for her to sit there in it, She could have lived in it last summer. She wanted to go in it all the time. So she loved being outside. She loved the water. She was definitely a water girl. Loved the movies, loved ice cream. You know, enjoy every moment. Don't worry about tomorrow. Just try to take care of today, because nobody's promised tomorrow, you know.
Right. Right.
It's very hard to do that, but that's some of the best advice I can give right now.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's great, because, you know, I have a lot of people asking as they find out about Megan's diagnosis, you know, well, oh, how are you doing? Oh, you know, and I'm like, well, but it's not here yet. We've got time. It's still today. Right. I don't think about the end. I know what the end is going to come, but we're not there yet. So let's have fun today. Let's give extra hugs today. Let's give extra kisses today. How can we make it more fun today? You definitely have a different perspective on life. And I really feel sorry for those people who do get very focused on the things that really don't matter. Right.
it gives you a whole new perception of what life really is. Mm-hmm. You know, live your life, enjoy it, and you know, make the memories, because those are what count.
Right. That's good advice. Well, and I'm very sorry for the loss of both your husband and your daughter. But since that time, I understand you've still been involved in raising awareness for HD and JHD. Tell us what you're doing now and what drives you to continue to be a champion for the cause.
Well, first and foremost, I now have the time to do that I didn't have for like 15 years, right? Because I was always caring for somebody. So I have the time, I have the energy, I want to do this. It's cathartic. I feel like I'm actually helping others. I'm in a helping profession at work. I like to help others. I like to feel like I make a difference. So I attended convention for the first time this year. It was life-changing. I loved it. I met so many wonderful people, learned a lot, shared a lot. I was asked to co-chair a juvenile Huntington's parent group. That was wonderful, not a big turnout, but it was the first year for JHD. So I think, you know, in subsequent years, the possibility is going to be that it'll be bigger. I'm going back to the support group now. I am now on the board of directors for our Massachusetts chapter for HDSA, and I'm also working on getting a 501c3 together for Meg's Fight for a Cure Juvenile Huntington's Disease Foundation. So I have my own thing going on here so that I can raise funds for JHD and specifically those that are working. So much more needs to happen in this area, and I want to help as much as I can. So I want this foundation. It'll be an annual fundraiser that I do for her in her memory. So that to me right now is one of the biggest gifts that I can give. And like I said, it's cathartic for me. So I feel like I'm actually doing something.
Yeah. Well, we all thank you in the JHT community, and definitely need to bring more light and awareness to the struggles that the kids go through, and the distinct difference between the care your husband received was glowing, right, versus the trial and error and lack of help you received even up until the very end is something that I definitely would love to be a part of the change. So I thank you for being a part of that and continuing to use your free time now and still caring for you're still caregiving for the greater community. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Kinzer, for joining me. I'm so glad I got to interview you today. And that concludes our show. I want to thank everyone for listening, and please have a good night. Thank you.
Thanks, Dina.